We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 21.
David Martin for the win. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Hufflepuff extraordinaire David Martin, who was part of the winning team on TBS's Tournament of Houses. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Emily, you and I were both glued to TBS's Tournament of Houses,
yes,
a four-part Harry Potter quiz bowl game in celebration of 20 years since the first Harry Potter movie came out, Sorcerer's Stone. And I know that you were also glued to the TV because we were texting back and forth the whole time.
That was fun.
So
it was a watch party.
Yes, that's right. Tell us, what did you think of the competition?
Well, it just was an utter delight. I had so much fun, and I think it was even more fun because I was acquainted with one of the contestants, and it was really, really fun to cheer on David Martin and to cheer on Hufflepuff. I my son and I were both rooting for Hufflepuff, even though I'm a Gryffindor and he's sort of a Griffin Claw, my husband is a Hufflepuff, so that helped. But I thought, you know, David Martin is just bringing out the Hufflepuff in all of us. So we just had a really good time watching the show.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, and I've been sorted into all the houses, so I can get behind, you know, whomever. But the Hufflepuff team just seemed like a great team. And like you said, we could cheer David on. And also, our friend Louise Freeman was in the audience. And I loved trying to scan the audience to see her. I was not successful.
I did too. I think you had to have very sharp eyes.
But
those masks made it challenging. Everybody was double masked in the audience, and it made it challenging to recognize people.
Yes, absolutely. So we are joined today by David Martin, one third of the winning Hufflepuff team, a retired computer programmer and a longstanding Harry Potter scholar who comes at the books from a different kind of angle. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And so, congratulations on your win.
Yes.
Well, it was a team win, really. I won't be falsely modest. I know I was the star player, but we absolutely won as a team. There is no way I did this single-handed.
It's true. You even missed one.
I did. I missed two, actually.
Oh, two. Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah. So, and just, I guess we should say, I probably should have said it earlier, listeners, there are spoilers.
Yeah. Even the title is a spoiler.
The title is also a little bit of a spoiler. So, but you will enjoy watching it anyway. So,
yes.
So if you haven't watched it, you can still watch it. And it's been up on the TBS website and at the TBS app. Streaming services like Hulu, Sling TV, YouTube TV, DirecTV have had it as well. And it looks like in 2022, you will be able to stream the series on HBO Max with a subscription to that. So those are some ways that you can see it if you feel like you missed it. Depending on, you know, when this when this episode airs and when you're listening to it, you might have a different set of options there. But we hope that you'll watch it and you will not be disappointed, even knowing who the winners were.
Yeah, it's like Harry Potter. It's like the Harry Potter series in that sense. Even if you know the outcome, it's still worth a watch. It's still worth a read.
For sure. And, you know, this was listed as cable's top new unscripted show. So it got huge ratings. And I also thought it really showed Harry Potter fans like at our best. I think we were all pretty impressive on that show. And I would include the audience members in that too.
I am aware that this sounds a little bit like patting myself on the back, but as I look at the contestants that I got to know a little bit well, they were such good sports. I never heard one time anybody griping up, oh, I should have gotten that, or I should have been picked. No, none of that. They were all really good sports, you know, and they applauded when you got something right, even if they were on the other team. I don't know how they managed to select such nice people, really. Or maybe just Harry Potter fans are naturally nice. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Yeah, even the Slytherins were very nice, I thought.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it, but Ryan on the Slytherin team is getting a lot of play out on social media.
Yeah. He was very likable, and I loved how he knew so much about Dolores Umbridge.
Yeah, I know. That was delightful. So much fun.
I think we even got a hem from him at one point.
Yeah. And David, your teammates were Adriana and Luke. And
right.
It looked like you all got along really well.
We did.
It was a good team. Good team.
Yeah. Winning combination. Yeah.
So one of the things that did kind of crack me up a little bit, David, doing what I do, was that, you know, each of the contestants was asked how they came to know and love the Harry Potter books. And of course, it's a show, right, about the competition. And so they give people like 10 seconds to answer this question. And Emily and I know that people can talk about how they came to know and love the Harry Potter books for a long time. And it was so funny to me how you just got this little tidbit and you knew there was a huge story behind it. And so I thought I would ask you to elaborate on your answer to this question. So Davis, tell us in full, how did you first discover the Harry Potter books? And what led you to take them seriously as literature?
Okay, the story begins with my wife. My wife was at that time a school librarian in an elementary school. And there was this gossip, this rumor among the school librarians that there was this new series of books out that really gets kids excited and makes them read. So, of course, she mentioned this, and then I saw one in the bookstore, and I said, well, let's see what this is about. And it was kind of an impulse purchase. But I read it. At that time, only the first book was out. I've had to go back and check my records very carefully on that. The second book came out within a month or so, and so I bought it. And by the time they were doing midnight releases, I was there for them. I guess I began to take them seriously when somewhere along the line, I heard the author's statement that the Dementors were based on her experience with depression. And I've always had an interest in psychology. And so I thought, maybe there's other psychological things in here. And I started going through it. And my first attempt at a kind of a presentation, which wasn't very good, was to attempt to look at other things in the series that might be explained in psychological terms. By now, these are all pretty well known. I mean, obviously, boggarts are phobias. Obviously, the mirror of Erised is daydreaming, and on like that. But the more I dug into them, the more I just began to find things that were interesting and fun to talk about. And then, of course, I went to the conferences. First conference I went to was one in Philadelphia, Enlightenment 2007, which was held at the University of Pennsylvania. And if you've never heard of it, don't worry about it. It was a one-time event. And then it, after that, my next one was 2010 Infinitus in Orlando. But I began to go to these conferences and I began making some presentations, having some success with them. I guess there are kind of like three presentations that I'm happiest with. One is the presentation about why wizards use old-fashioned things. And with the background in technology, I simply realized, oh, they use old-fashioned things because that's what existed when they went into hiding. And that required digging up a few things, hours and hours searching in Wikipedia for, I don't know, maybe 10 seconds at a time, finding out things like when did they first start using postage stamps in Britain? And yes, that was after the wizards had gone into hiding. So, of course, the wizards don't know how to use postage stamps. Likewise, matches.
Right, ballpoint pens, you know. Yeah.
And
That's such a great essay, David. I think it's so important, the idea that they've been kind of technologically frozen in time since the International Statute of Secrecy. So such a cool idea. Well done.
And then just, well, as I say, just noticing the things like that the borough has multiple chimneys. Why do you have multiple chimneys? You have multiple chimneys because you don't have central heating. And every place is being heated by fireplaces. So that's a fairly successful one. Then another one I had was what Americans misunderstand about Harry Potter. And I had the great advantage of living in Britain for about 18 months years ago, back in the 70s. And this just made me aware of a lot of little things, like the fact that Mr. Weasley collects plugs. This sounds stupid until you begin to understand that, in fact, there are people in Britain who do this because they didn't standardize the electrical connections in Britain until, I think, maybe like the 1960s or 70s. And so if you buy an electrical appliance, you have to go out and find the kind of plug that fits what you have in your house.
Huh. And that's like fascinating.
And there's like five or six different ones that are common. And you don't have to do a lot of research on this. I simply went online to a electrical supply company in Britain and was able to produce slides showing, you know, half a dozen different things. And then, of course, when you buy such a plug, it comes with a little pamphlet showing you exactly how to wire it. And you will recall that Mr. Weasley has such a little diagram on his wall at the Ministry of Magic. So anyway, that was a fairly successful one. And then I did one which was for fun and for humor. It was a one-time inspiration, and I've never come up with anything nearly as funny. I tried to figure out what was in the 12 fail-safe ways to charm witches. And I've done that presentation about six times, I guess, and it always is a real audience pleaser, because what I do in that presentation is I basically make fun of the stupid things that men do. I deliver actually good advice, but in the most male chauvinistic terms. I don't know, have either of you seen that presentation?
You know, you sent it to me, David, a while ago, and I'm still I'm waiting for that moment to enjoy it. It's currently in my inbox, but I can't wait to look at it because it just sounds so funny.
Oh my gosh, it sounds hilarious, David.
Well, a small sample. What I try to do is I try to look at Ron before and after he got the book, and one of the things I point to is in the third book. Now, Ron and Hermione fight in every book, but in the third book, what they fight about is the fact that they think that the cat has eaten Ron's rat. The way they are finally reconciled is when Hermione comes to them and says, Buckbeak has been condemned. And in the moment, Ron says, no, we'll appeal, I'll help you. And Hermione comes forward and throws her arms around his neck and says, oh, Ron, I'm so sorry about Scabbers. And Ron is terrified, as any proper 13-year-old boy would. So then, flash forward 3 years, another time when Hermione's upset, Dumbledore's funeral. What happens then? Well, Ron is holding Hermione. Ron is holding Hermione.
Ah.
And stroking her hair. And she cries. And I say, okay, what do you suppose the book said as a way, a fail-safe way to charm witches? Be a shoulder to cry on.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And then I go through, so I have something like, your witch will cry a lot. Get used to it. This is normal. When she cries, your job is to hold her. Don't give advice. Hold her. You know, and I go on. And then I say at the end of that one, if your witch cries more than normal, you might consider the special absorbent shoulder pads that now that Madam Malkin makes available. There's a 10% reduction in cost if you mention this book.
Oh, I love it.
Anyway, that's clever. What I was, but I give actual good advice, but I do it in the most male chauvinistic tone. And that, so I say that was a big success.
So, sort of self-deprecating.
Yes.
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 Yes. That's very good. Well, I can't wait to enjoy that. And frankly, I think, David, you'd have a very large YouTube audience if you chose to put any of that content up on YouTube. I think you would get a lot of subscribers at this point, because that is all very delightful sounding.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, David, what made you think to try out for TBS's Tournament of Houses, and what was the audition process like?
I picked up the notice about it from John Granger's website, the HogwartsProfessor.com. I then filled out the form, and that was on a Thursday afternoon. And on Friday afternoon, I got a phone call, and they asked me a few questions, just very basic ones about, you know, what's the name of the actress that plays Hermione Granger? And I knew that one. And then they had one question, which they thought nobody... They said, nobody's ever getting this, but we think you're going to get it. And I said, what's the question? They said, how many Canutes are there to a sickle?
Oh.
And how many sickles are there to a galleon?
Oh, uh-huh.
That's actually a really popular question in Harry Potter pub trivia, because I've done a lot of Harry Potter pub trivia, and that question always comes up.
Yeah, well.
Separating the sheep from the goats there with this one.
And I never know it. That's the sad thing. I never know it.
Well, I had used that. I constructed a programming assignment for my introduction to programming class that uses those numbers. And what I asked them to do was to write a program that calculates sales tax for items sold in Diagon Alley.
I love it.
So, yes, I knew those numbers. 29 newts to a sickle and 17 sickles to a galleon, which and when you're actually figuring out the sales tax, one of the things that's helpful to know is how many newts there are to a galleon. And so you have to multiply 17 times 29, which is 493. So I knew all those numbers.
You told them that whole thing.
Well, no, I just
29 and 17.
Just calmly answered the question.
Yeah. But then he said, okay, we'd like to do a Zoom interview with you. And he gave me a time, and then I found some, I got an email. And so I had a Zoom interview, and that was more questions about the books and about me. And then they actually asked for essentially audition tapes. They wanted to see me just talking about something. They asked for three samples, and my one daughter, my daughter Esther, happened to be home just then, and so she coached me on exactly how she did that. She, you know, how one should do this. She had very strong ideas on the matter, and so I did three short presentations. One was on the nature of the Potter Panic. The Potter Panic was very intense, but it was actually shorter than people think often. And I was able to talk about that a bit. And I talked briefly about what Americans misunderstand about the books, because the books are British, and something else. Anyway, we sent off those three little audition tapes, as it were. And then they came back and they kept asking for additional information. At a certain point, they said, okay, we want to investigate your background. And they gave me a form to fill out, like a 12-page form. And they wanted to know every place I'd lived since I graduated from high school. And they wanted to know all of my previous marriages and any lawsuits I was involved in and a whole bunch of stuff like
Gosh.
That.
Wow.
I said, no, none of that. That hasn't happened, no.
And, just a simple man, right?
Well, I when I reached the end, I had to write a note and said, I apologize to whatever investigator is going to take this on. It's going to be terribly dull. But they also wanted personal references, including three people who had known me since high school. All right, I was 76
Wow.
when I was filling that out. Actually, I was able to come up with that. Then they also asked me my vaccine status. They wanted to know if I was vaccinated. And then a little while later, they actually asked for proof of that vaccination. So I had to send them photos of my vaccine card.
Mm-hmm.
They were very conscious about COVID through this whole process. Now, I don't know much about the selection process in a way, except that when we were finally invited and had our way paid out to Los Angeles, they brought out six people for each house. And they told us ahead of time, there will be a final casting step. We got there on a Sunday. We left on a Sunday. The filming was actually done on the Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. The first 3 days we were there, they basically kept us locked down in the hotel. We had our meals in the hotel or in our rooms. They administered two COVID tests to us, well, three totally, one on Monday, one on Wednesday, one on Friday. Come by in the morning, take samples, and then by the evening, we get the results back. As I mentioned, they brought in six people for each house. On, I think it was Wednesday, they put us through some training sessions. That is, they showed us how the games would work. They had some samples, and they would have, for instance, all six Hufflepuffs in the room together. And they would break us up into teams of threes, left and right, and we'd have to compete against the other practice team.
And they were seeing what your dynamic was up with the other contestants. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they would do us a certain way, and we'd do one exercise, and they'd say, "Okay, you shift over there, and have her go over there," you know, and they sort us around. So what I've realized since is, duh, this was our screen test, but they showed us what the questions would be like. For instance, you know, there is that question, that kind of question they did where you have to observe something very closely. I remember the one they used on us, just mind-blowing. It's the scene where at the Yule Ball, when Hermione confronts Ron, comes over and talks to Ron and Harry, and Ron's very angry at her for consorting with the enemy. And Hermione looks at him and says something, turns around, starts to go away, comes back and looks at him one more time, then goes, the question is, how many combs did Hermione have in her hair?
What? Oh, my gosh. So that's why you were primed to be looking that detailed so you could get the Roman numerals.
I knew it was going to be some detail that went by fast. But I forget what the answer was. It was either two and we guessed three or three and we guessed two. I know we got it wrong.
that's a real Hufflepuff answer, right? You remember the one you got wrong.
Yeah, well. And anyway, you were asking about the selection process. I thought they might at a certain point tell us. They didn't. What happened is, when the time came for making our broadcast, and we happened to be the first matchup, as you know, is Gryffindor versus Hufflepuff.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, do you notice the houses always mentioned in the same order? It's alphabetical order.
Yeah.
Anyway, So Gryffindor and Hufflepuff, they took us all to the studio. They got us all set. You know, they did our hair and put makeup on us, if necessary, powder. That's why I look so good in the films. And
we thought that was just you.
Oh, it's kind of you. And then they put us in the audience. And the only clue, looking at it afterwards, is they told us very specifically where to sit. They had assigned seats for each of us. In retrospect, mm-hmm. they knew then who they were going to use. And they were putting us in those spots so that the cameras could be ready to focus on us when we were selected.
But so, it still was really a little bit of a surprise that you got called. Oh, that's cool.
And since I was the very last one called, I had just resigned myself to saying, well, this was good. I got this far. I met some nice people. I mm-hmm. had some adventures. But then I was called. And so I was quite surprised.
That's great.
Then the other three people who had been selected for Hufflepuff just remained in the audience. And as they say, they were very good sports about it. They were up there. They were cheering us on. I'm sure I know the same thing happened with the other houses, too, as much as I got to know some of the other houses.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I loved how they let the audience, you know, that was part of the particular house, that they let them answer questions to contribute to the final score, because that actually did end up being significant. And it was really fun to see. I don't know, it gave you that feeling of like the whole house is behind it. I really like that aspect of the game.
Yeah. The producers have of this show did a major interview for the Hollywood Reporter a while ago. And but you will recall that they kept saying they had a real difficult time figuring out what was a hard question and what
right.
was an easy question, because mm-hmm. you know, they think something like, oh man, nobody will remember where Tom Riddle actually got Hufflepuff's cup from.
Right.
Everybody remembers where Tom Riddle got Hufflepuff's cup from.
It's hard to stump Harry Potter fans, to be honest. If you're a real deep dive fan of either the books or the movies or both, it is hard to stump people like that. And that's why, I mean, we're getting into some of the questions, but some of the questions seems like, well, this kind of question would stump anybody, you know, which maybe was appropriate, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there was this real diversity of questions, and I can see that it would be hard to judge, what's hard, what's easy, what's in the sweet spot, you know? So uh-huh. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about which questions you felt like stumped you and which ones you were much more comfortable with?
The ones which stumped me, which I found challenging, the ASIO questions where they bring out props.
Oh yeah.
I've gone over the scores on those, and here's the way it works out. There were four ASIO questions in the four contests. Twice, neither team scored. Once, the first team missed it and the other team was able to steal. And just once, the first team got it the first time out.
And that was the oven mitts.
Which that was amazing. I would never have been able to pick that out. But like Hermione Granger's parents' couch. Like, come on. Wow. That's brutally hard. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That was. And I also thought the, let's see, what was the other one that nobody got on?
Was it Dumbledore's office?
No, that was
the They got that one. Yeah, that's right. But I've also mm-hmm. thought, like there's a ton of stuff in his office.
Yeah. It was the diadem.
Yes.
Oh yeah, that one was hard.
That
Which
one was
one's
real
the
hard.
Real diadem? But how cool that you actually got to see the props that were used in the film. I thought that was a kind of fun way to connect with the films, you know.
Well, the practice question they gave us on that was they brought in a wand and they showed it to us and we could handle it and look at it, and they said the question was, whose wand is it?
Lordy.
That's tough.
And
yeah.
That one we got wrong, and in the practice, our my practice team, whatever that was, got it wrong. And the other practice team, somebody able to look at it and say, that's Hermione's wand. How that person knew, I have no idea.
Wow. But now, David, part of your claim to fame is that you actually knew some that people were like, wow. and your team was able to get some that seemed like they were a little challenging. So where, for you, where was the comfort level with the questions?
First of all, it's when they're asking things in the books, because right. I'm much more familiar with the books than with the movies. And secondly, when they were sometimes they would ask things like, I thought it was a very good question they gave, which of these was not a rule that Dolores Umbridge passed?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, uh-huh.
Needed four changes. I thought that was a good one. I also thought it was reasonably good and challenging when they showed you clips from the movies and they say, now what happens next? You know, and it's a little pause. And I got two of those right.
You stole one too, in terms of what Voldemort was saying about his and Harry's wands.
That's right.
That was on the final episode. When
I know that was when Hufflepuff was almost not going to make it to the final. That was so intense. Oh my gosh.
And that was, and I only got that because I think it was Lauren, Laurie.
It was Louise.
Louise.
On the other team muffed it because, surprise, surprise, one of the things we old guys are not so good at is speed. And I was time and again of the questions that had gone by before that, I think I knew all of them or maybe all of them but one.
Mm-hmm.
But I simply wasn't able to hit the buzzer fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so that on that one time, I didn't have to have a speed one. They re-edited that, by the way. The way it really went down was this. Louise answered the question and said, brothers, and I hit my button immediately. And then Helen looked at me, and she was obviously getting instructions through her ear. And so she said, yes, Louise, that answer's wrong. And David hit his button, so what's the answer? But what they edited it to, they had edited it so that Louise gives her answer. Helen tells her she's wrong, and then they show me hitting the button. To just make it in a more logical sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But
yes.
Louise told me later that she knew that answer was wrong as soon as she said it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And you know, it was funny because that was the answer I said as well out loud when I heard the question. I said, brothers, you know, and then I was really surprised that it was wrong. But I was impressed, David, at how well you did with the film content because I myself, like with my focus on the books, I don't really watch the films very often. So I was really impressed. I was like, David is really holding his own with these films as well as mm-hmm. as the books.
Well, I crammed on the film. I had figured out
mm-hmm.
About the second or third day we were out there that, they're going to be emphasizing the films.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had all the films with me on DVDs. And so I sat there in my hotel room watching them.
Spoken like a true Hufflepuff. That's the best, David.
It paid off.
Doing your homework.
You know, I have long kind of referred to you in my mind as David Martin of Hufflepuff because that is how you tend to introduce yourself when you make presentations. And I've seen several of your presentations at Chestnut Hill. And so I always think of you as David Martin of Hufflepuff. So how did it feel to represent Hufflepuff in the Tournament of Houses, and how do you think house identities played into the show?
Well, house identities are kind of interesting in that once people identify in a certain way, they then kind of start feeling like they have to behave that way.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited to be chosen for the contest. And mostly then it was simply a matter of I wanted to win, to do well. So I don't know.
Hey, David, did you get to pick your house? I mean, was it the kind of thing where they said, which house are you? And then that was the one you were trying out for?
Okay. Oh, yes. That was part of the application process. Very early on, they said, which house are
you?
But they just took your word for it. They didn't like make you take the Wizarding World test or anything like that.
An official quiz.
I am self-selected Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when I took the test at Wizarding World, they still call me a Gryffindor there, but oh well, I'm only into Wizarding World for doing other things, so I don't care if they call me a Gryffindor.
Gryffindor might have needed you in this tournament.
No, we chose our own house. And I felt I'm self-selected for Hufflepuff simply because I identify with those values. The importance of hard work, the importance of loyalty, friendship, of decent human relation skills along with hard work. The world calls me a Ravenclaw, or at least they did when I was in elementary school and college, in that I was the kid who got the national merit, you know, and I was the kid who was in the gifted program. And I've worked in a very brainy field of computer programming. But I've also known a number of people who think that their high IQ excuses them from actually having to know anything. And that just makes me annoyed. So I'm Hufflepuff by choice.
Yeah, and Hufflepuff is sometimes, you were saying this, they're kind of the underdog, you know, they sort of get, you know, they're, what does Hagrid say, loaded duffers or something like that. And then, you know, you've got the play puffs that sort of built on the fact that they're kind of marginalized as a house. And then, you know, but obviously, if you think about it, I think to us, like, they're a great house. And those values are some of the most important core values to have.
Yeah.
And it seems like you really identify with that part of it.
I do now, anyway, I do. So, yeah, and I was happy to be there. And a lot of the reaction I've gotten on social media has simply been people who are Hufflepuffs, and they're saying, oh, wow, it's so great to actually see our team win.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that played into it, that, you know, Hufflepuff is just kind of always takes the underdog role in any Harry Potter sort of scenario. And, you know, maybe that's unjust, and maybe, you know, part of your team's performance on the show is helping to sort of break that down. But at the same time, it's everyone likes an underdog too. So it did make your team very likable.
And I did think, like, the Hufflepuff versus Slytherin finale, that was sort of an amazing matchup of opposites, right. You know, but the Slytherins all look like they were really nice people too. But I like that sense of competition that came through. So yeah. David, you have become like a TikTok and Twitter phenom since the very first episode came out.
You're going viral.
And our mutual friend, Louise Freeman, who was in the audience for the show, she actually posted at hogwartsprofessor.com an article where she talked about how the Tournament of Houses, she said, wins the House Cup for ratings, and Twitter declares HogPros David of Hufflepuff the MVP. And so there were some tweets that I thought I would share that Louise had compiled. And this was just after the first episode. So let's see. Jer the Otter Bear said, David is the most Hufflepuffiest Hufflepuff of all Hufflepuffs, which I thought was great. Let's see. I want David to be happy, but I'm a Gryffindor. Help. That was funny.
I like that one.
David was a Badger Beast. Happy to be a fellow Hufflepuff with him. And then I like this one too, short and sweet. David would have defeated Voldemort.
Confidence.
Isn't that great?
Real confidence. Yeah. And I'm refreshing, searching for the hashtag Tournament of Houses and David on Twitter right now. And I mean, it's just, David, it's amazing. It's just all positive. No one in the history of humanity has ever had only positive tweets about them on Twitter.
Well, they must not know me very well.
Maybe not. No, they did that background check. You never know. It says, this person says, I got to root for Ravenclaw because that's my house. I almost want to root for Hufflepuff just because of David.
I have been surprised at the reaction. And I think part of the reaction is simply that I'm old, and what I mean is when a 77-year-old gray-haired man stands up and says, we should take these books seriously, all of a sudden that elevates them beyond being mere children's books.
Right.
And somehow makes it more allowable, more tolerable for people who are far beyond childhood to continue to look at and think about the books in a serious manner.
That's very wise. And I also think it was just really clear that you took it very seriously. You were in it. You were in it to win it.
Yeah. Somebody said, I ran across one earlier that said, David understood the assignment. Which I think is very true.
Oh, that's funny.
On a lot of levels.
Yeah. It's been an amazing experience. But now I'm, and my three adult children have been become an ad hoc social media management team for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've got my oldest, my son, doing Twitter. Then my middle child, Sarah, out in California, is doing Instagram. And my youngest, Esther, here in Wisconsin with me, is doing TikTok. And it's been a tremendous family effort.
What about that cup? Like, you guys don't actually get that cup. This is like, what is the cup? What is with the cup?
Well, as far as I know, the cup remains the property of Warner Media and
okay.
is still out in California. But as I said, I really don't think it would fit in with the decor in my apartment.
I thought that was the best comment, David. I love that. Where's this going to fit in my apartment?
I tend to be a ham in front of an audience and make wisecracks. And they cut out some of my best ones.
Oh no!
But they did keep the one where Helen asked, you know, why are you asking the questions in this order? And I said, well, it's courtesy, ladies first.
Yeah, they retweeted that too. Yeah. I noticed online.
But yeah. For instance, when we're examining the oven mitts, somebody said something like, well, do these look big enough for a giant? And I said, now, wait a minute. While Hagrid is a giant, the actor playing him was a mere mortal human being.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Helen said, I don't think anything that Robbie Coltrane does could be regarded as mere immortal.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, that was fun banter.
That should make like the, you know, the blooper reel or something.
Yeah, we definitely need the blooper reel. Yeah.
So I will tell you, David, that when you said for that one that was the 10-point question that was about how many house points yeah. Hufflepuff had gotten at the end
Come
of the first
on.
One, I was like, that was, wow, that was tough. And they were all so close to each other. And then you said, yeah. Well, I'm glad this is only 10 points. And Emily texted me. She's like, David is not joking about that. We were worried.
Yeah. Well, we had some cliffhangers and there was definitely
oh, yeah.
not enough luck in it. I will tell you something funny about the Hufflepuff win. I am living in Wisconsin now, but for the last 40 years until last July, I lived in the Philadelphia area, which is why I was able to go to Chestnut Hill conferences so easily. My teammate, Luke, lives in New York City, and Adriana lives in Orlando, Florida. Now, for the prize-winning team, the promised prizes are, first of all, an all-expense-paid trip to Orlando to visit the world, the Harry Potter world there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that for Adriana, that means they'll pay for her bus fare or something.
Oh.
And then the next prize is an all-expense-paid trip to New York City.
Right.
And tickets to the Cursed Child play on Broadway. Well, the tickets will be nice, but again, I figured that for Luke, this just means they'll pay for his subway fare or something. And then the other one is they'll pay our transportation to go and see the Harry Potter exhibit that's opening. Do you know where it is? You guessed, right? The Harry Potter exhibit is in Philadelphia at the Franklin Institute. Okay. Opening in February. So I get a trip back to the place I left 6 months ago. So It's kind of strange, you know. Couldn't they have, you know, given us a trip to London or something?
That oh wow!
Well, yes,
those
David,
prizes.
you're turning Slytherin. Your ambition is showing.
Well, you know, you have to outgrow your houses at a certain point.
There you go.
Incorporate what's necessary from other houses.
So. Yeah. So I have to say though, I thought that the prizes were well chosen in terms of like the fan experience, you know, yeah. and like picking yeah. things that fans would just really geek on and love. So that was fun at least.
I'm using the impetus. This has given me the impetus to go ahead and finish something that I kind of been working on and off for the last 4 years. And that is collecting my various papers and presentations and trying to publish it as a book.
Oh, great.
Yes. Good
and
idea.
I'm hoping that will happen in the near future. And
wonderful, David. You have and a name now. Yeah.
Well, we'll have to have you back on the show when you've pulled that together and have a, you know, a release date. And we'll have to talk more about that.
Well,
that'd be great.
Nice. And then I've also got some additional areas of, well, I guess I'd call them scholarship to look into. This one I did on trees most recently, that began as kind of a hunch, saying, I know that Rowling has always paid a lot of attention to the significance of flowers of one kind and another. Many people have written scholarly essays on that bit. And I found myself wondering, I wonder if she's done anything like that with trees. And the time came up when you had to put in your proposed outlines for the Chestnut Hill Conference, and I said, yeah, well, I'll do something on the symbolism of trees. I'll bet there's something there. And I hadn't really looked at it, so it's kind of a gutsy thing to do.
Oh, wow.
On the other hand, I always feel that Chestnut Hill is very forgiving, so they will let pure amateurs just go ahead and try something. And so they did. And I started digging, and I found stuff. The most surprising thing I found that I did not expect to find at all was to find out that there is a line in the Silver Doe chapter in the seventh book in which Ron is about to destroy the Horcrux. And Harry says, the script says, Harry held up Hermione's wand and looked around and found the perfect place, a flat rock in the shadow of a sycamore tree. Well, knowing that good authors don't waste words, I thought, why the heck is she telling us it's in the shadow of a sycamore tree? Now, other places when trees are mentioned, you can tell what she's after. For instance, the yew tree is associated with death and also with resurrection. And yew trees are mentioned in the graveyard scene in the fourth book, right? Mm-hmm. Surprise, surprise. Yew trees are very common in British graveyards. But then they're also mentioned in the fifth book when Hagrid is introducing them to Thestrals. The first Thestral that arrives pushes his way between two yew trees. Mm. There's a reason he's saying they're yew trees.
Definitely.
So then I got back to looking at this sycamore, and I went up and I looked over all the things of sycamore trees. And after looking at all the things, I finally concluded this is actually a reference to the story in the Gospel according to Luke about Zacchaeus climbing up in a sycamore tree so he can see Jesus.
Oh.
And the reason it's connected is because if you go back and look at that story, it takes up like the whole first, takes up the first like 10 lines, I think, in that chapter. It's a story of Zacchaeus, who was alienated from the group and an outcast. He was a tax collector. And due to his interaction with Jesus, he basically does a full confession and repentance, and he tries to make up for what he's done, and he ends up being reaccepted in the community. And that's when I realized, oh, this is something about Ron. Ron has been gone.
Yes.
And he comes back and he does things to make up for it.
Right.
And he's reaccepted into the community, though it takes a while with Hermione. And so I figured, oh, that's what she's referring to.
Yeah, Ron had sold out. He had sold out, and not all the way, but he had started selling out, and he was coming back. And that it is a very Zacchaeus moment. I agree.
That's a beautiful idea.
All right, but the point of all this is the way I get ideas is I simply say, "Well, let's look and see if there's anything there." That's what I did with the books.
Yeah. No, it seems that you're everything I've ever seen you do has seemed to be born of very careful observation, and I really appreciate that about what you can notice when you just kind of take the time to really notice very closely. Yeah. So I think that I can't wait for the book.
Yeah. And like not underestimating what Rowling is doing in terms of planting those kinds of, you know, symbolic references that she is doing a lot intentionally and really recognizing that as well.
Something else I've noticed and that I'm going to be working on, I've noticed how many times the characters, particularly among the trio, it says they looked at each other. You know, Hermione, they're about to try do something. Oh yeah, it's when they're creeping into the Shrieking Shack, and Hermione and Harry are going up the stairs, and they're worried. And it says something like, Harry looked back at Hermione. And Hermione returned the look one more time. Then Harry nodded and went on. There's a whole lot of talking with faces. There's looks, there's frowns, there's smiles. Mm. And it just seems to me this is happening more with her than with other authors. Anyway, that's a little, the point is I'm thinking about other things conferences.
That's fascinating, David. You know, I was thinking about this also in terms of the fan experience of the show itself. But you wrote an article on Hogwarts Professor about people who do Harry Potter themed weddings, but also you looked at births and funerals, and seeing that a lot of the weddings don't even have, you know, like ministers as the officiants, and that Harry Potter is connecting with people in a way that is deeply meaningful in the same way that religion is. It's a sort of connection with the sacred for a lot of fans. And I felt like the spirit of the group last night, you know, when everybody was cheering, and I did feel a little bit of that, you know, that kind of special feeling of, you know, connecting with something greater. And I just thought that article that you'd written connected in so well with this experience.
It's always exciting to get together with a whole bunch of other people who are like you. I remember years ago, during the senior high school, a friend of mine had just come back from a science fair experience. And he said, "Really, you cannot imagine the excitement of seeing beating that aisle with all the other chemistry students who had exhibits there. You just can't imagine how exciting it is when a whole bunch of chemistry students get together." And I said, "I can imagine it exactly."
Yeah.
Right.
Because the same thing happens when you get a bunch of debate nerds together, or you get a bunch of mathematicians together. It's always exciting to be with other people like you and discover you're not the only one.
So, David, we know that you came to the books partly because your wife was a elementary school librarian, and she must have also given you some other good book ideas. And we have a question from a listener today that is going to ask about the books that you might read if you've loved Harry Potter and you're looking to try to recreate that experience. So for our special segment today, we are going to go to the Potterversity Library. So many of us read the Harry Potter books and then instantly want to try to repeat that experience with another series. And although that may not completely be possible, there are some precursors and successors to Harry Potter that might come close for people. So, David, do you have any suggestions for listeners about other books or series that you think capture some of the same magic that Harry Potter does?
From the same place I got the initial advice to read the Harry Potter's novels, I will give you the advice my wife gives. Talk to your librarian. Go to your public or your school library, if possible. Find a young adult librarian and just ask him or her about the books, because they will be up on what's new. They will be up on what's going. They can look at you and actually ask you what you're interested in. And that that may lead you in a very different direction.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking of was that the Harry Potter books, they're at the intersection of so many different kinds of things that I think it's hard to find something that captures all of that. But you may be more interested in, say, like some of the absurdity and the humor part, or you may be more interested in maybe some like deep fantasy, or, you know, maybe it's the epic quality that you like. And all those things are going to lead you in different directions for what your next series might be.
Now, of course, the ones which are mentioned most often will be the Chronicles of Narnia and the Lord of the Rings series. So I suppose those would be kind of basic. Beyond that, you might try, if you wish to be more scholarly, go and get John Granger's book called Harry Potter's Bookshelf.
Oh, yeah.
And let that be your guide to start reading. The author emerges from a strong literary tradition, and it is worthwhile to become aware of the other elements of that literary tradition. If you haven't read the Jane Austen novels, what's wrong with you? You know,
that's true.
Yeah. And, you know, I was also thinking Roald Dahl. I think she gets a lot of her humor. It's very similar to the way Roald Dahl does.
This is a bit dark.
Yeah.
I agree.
And I think the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books were not a bad sequel for my son, who liked Harry Potter.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Also very funny, very absurd.
Well, you pardon me if I'm telling you what you already know, but that was first a radio broadcast before it was a book.
That's interesting.
And so if you, in a sense, if you really want to get someone into that, seek out somewhere the original BBC recording. It was on the air back in 75, I think.
That's fascinating. All right.
Yeah, cool. I believe I listened to those books. I'm not sure if I listened to the original recording, but I know I listened to them. Yeah, they're very good in any kind of audio format as well. You know, I was thinking about other books people could read. And definitely, I would also piggyback on what David said about the Lord of the Rings, because Harry Potter really led me to the Lord of the Rings. And I think a lot of people have seen those movies, so they sort of know, they think they kind of know and understand that story. But it's just such a better, deeper, more meaningful story in the books than in Peter Jackson's films. The other books I would point to would be Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising series. And that is going to be more Oxford School children's fantasy literature. So Susan Cooper is very much formed in that same school as Lewis and Tolkien. And of course, Rowling is a descendant of that school as well, even though she did not attend Oxford. Another book that is a personal favorite of mine that I really think captures the epic quality of Harry Potter in terms of characters that you love going on an epic adventure in a totally different format is Watership Down by Richard Adams, which is, of course, the most epic bunny story that's ever been told. But it also rests on, you know, the platform of classic literature. And I think that because it draws so much on classic literature, it really resonates in many of the same ways as Harry Potter. Yeah. I asked my son this question, Katie, if I can tell you what he recommended.
Yes.
Yeah, he's 10. He's a big reader. He suggested the Land of Stories series by Chris Colfer. Yeah, he really enjoyed that. And then he also just recently read Artemis Fowl by Eoin Colfer, apparently no relation. And he enjoyed that. That's going to tease out the mystery story aspect of Harry Potter. And then another one we love is by Adam Gidwitz, who's a great up-and-coming author. It's called The Inquisitor's Tale. And that's also going to the religious themes in Harry Potter and the kind of just themes of the humanistic themes, the themes of just really being a good a good person, the best person you can be, and the kind of magic that comes from that, I think mm-hmm. is definitely present in that story as well.
Yeah. So my husband recommended Piers Anthony books, the Xanth series with an X, Xanth. And he said, A Spell for Chameleon is the first one. And that was in the 1970s. And then my younger son has really liked the Rick Riordan books, which, you know, there are tons of them. Percy mm-hmm. Jackson is just one of the series, but he's now a fourth grader, but he's just been charging through. And there's so many of those to read that I think those are very readable. My kids also like The Alchemist by Michael Scott. And that's a whole series. It's kind of like the, you know, kids solving deep mystery. I think it's also, I was going to give you my daughter's recommendation. She didn't make it through all the Harry Potter books because she didn't like how they were getting into trouble all the time. And she is liking the Septimus Heap books. The first one is called Magic, M-A-G-Y-K, by Angie Sage. And I said, do you like this one? And she said, yeah, it's like Harry Potter, except the kids don't do so many stupid things. So I thought that was a good selling point for the books. But also Akata Witch by Nnedi Okorafor, which is a 3-book series. And it's an American-born African-American girl who goes to Nigeria and kind of discovers her African witchy roots, which I think is really, really cool.
Yeah. There's some really neat fantasy books coming out with people exploring mythology of not just the UK or Europe, you know, and those are some really, Rebecca Warhorse has done some of that. And, Tony Adeyemi Toby Adeyemi has done some of that. So really not all for younger readers,
right.
But more for adults.
Yeah. I had divided my list into things for younger readers. And then as you sort of said, there were these other ones like Rebecca Roanhorse, Trail of Lightning, and then Children of Blood and Bone. And I think it's Children of Virtue and Vengeance is the second one in that series by Tomi Adeyemi. Yeah. And they're really good if you're an adult, I think, or like young adult, I think probably enjoy those. Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere. I love that one.
That's a good one. Also The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman.
Oh yeah. That one's great. And how about,
we could go on and on.
I know. Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Uh-huh.
That's a good one. Lev Grossman, and The Magicians.
Yes, definitely. I asked for, Piranesi for Christmas, which is also Suzanne Clarke. Mm-hmm. Because I've heard such wonderful things about Piranesi. Again, I think more for adult readers, but.
Mm-hmm. And definitely. Another one that's, again, for adult readers, Deborah Harkness's A Discovery of Witches. Oh man, how much did I love that as a historian?
I need to read
just
that.
Just wonderful, wonderful. So, all such great possibilities. And I do think, you know, we sort of jokingly talk about Harry Potter as like a gateway drug for reading great books. And I think it has, you know, like you were saying that your wife had said, David, that the Harry Potter books they've opened up not just one generation, but multiple generations to a whole slew of types of reading, so that reading became a thing that people were excited to do again, you know, and book releases were exciting. And I think that that's still been able to carry on.
I've always been a bit bothered by the fact that when people are giving book recommendations, particularly book recommendations for children, it is almost always fiction.
Hmm.
And there's, you know, what happened to the nonfiction? There is some very important nonfiction to read too, just books that kind of tell you about the world. Let's start with an old standby, the Guinness Book of World Records. That is extremely popular with about fourth graders.
Yeah.
They just go crazy in it. And that's because they're old enough to read, old enough to understand it. And it helps them start to scale their world and begin to understand their place in it.
Hmm.
Also, it's not quite the same thing, but what about a good atlas of the world or a globe? These are things that merit studying too and knowing about.
Yeah, that's true.
My kids have really liked historical biography. So, and there are some really great biography series that will just take a, you know, a famous person and, you know, a scientist, like there's that, the Who Is series.
The Who Is series, yeah.
Who Is Rachel Carson. My daughter loved that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the I Survived series
is
also really popular with the kind of 8 to 12 age range, because it puts you in the midst of these historical, you know,
disasters.
Events. Yeah. Disaster. Oh, my kids gosh. Love disasters. Oh, my
gosh. Oh, yeah. I mean, and these are real nail biters. Right. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So some wonderful books that introduce mathematics. Let me recommend one. There's one called The Number Devil.
That sounds good.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that book is it was originally, the author is in fact an established literary author in Germany. In German, the book is originally written in German, but it's available in English translation. And I gave that to a nephew, gosh, must be 20 years ago now. And what happened is he couldn't put it down for 3 days. He was so fascinated going through it.
Wow.
And then there's also in the math book, there's a book which goes by the punny title, Humble Pi. And Pi is written as P-I, meaning, of course, the mathematical symbol. And that would be for a slightly older student. I think you'd have to be at, say, junior high or even high school level to properly appreciate that. But all of these are books which open up aspects of the real world, of the nonfiction world, in ways that I think are very helpful for people growing up.
I agree.
Those are great tips. Great tips.
Yeah.
I'm
lots
sorry, I did all my Christmas shopping already. Those seem like things I need to add to my list.
I was sitting here on my phone app, on the library app, ordering books as people named them. So I've got some treats coming from the local library.
All right. Well, listeners, you have heard it from right here. You have lots of book ideas. So get busy reading and let us know if you stumble upon something that you think we should be talking about. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you so much, David, for joining us today and letting us share in your victory lap.
Oh, well, thank you.
So I'm going to end today with a quote from Minerva McGonagall, who said in The Sorcerer's Stone, "While you are at Hogwarts, your triumphs will earn your house points, while any rule breaking will lose house points. At the end of the year, the house with the most points is awarded the House Cup, a great honor. I hope each of you will be a credit to whichever house becomes yours." Cheers to David Martin, a credit to his house, and a Hufflepuff through and through.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to PotterversityPodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.